Hello, Page Turners. Welcome to our very special 50th episode. When we started this podcast almost a year ago, it was a lot of it had to do with our love for White Noise. We started with Ram V, and we've tried to have all these creators on that we love from that group. But I got introduced to White Noise from a DC book called Lucifer, which is the first time I heard of the writer we have on today. I loved it. And then I kind of found out about the rest of the writers and kind of fell in love with all their writing. But we're very honored to have on the writer of Limbo, Coffin Bound, Homesick Pilots, The Picture of Everything Else, and many more in the just released Arkham City. Thank you so much for coming on, Dan. How are you? We have Dan Waters, which is that the correct pronunciation?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, I wanted to make sure it wasn't like Waters or something.
I get a lot of Waters.
Been pronouncing it wrong.
But yeah,
Waters.
Yes.
I literally looked at the two T's this week and was like, have I been pronouncing it wrong the whole time? Are we going to start the episode off? And he's going to be like, it's not that. And I'm going to you're like, oh no!
You know, that's what editing's for.
You know what my dad did say to me like kind of recently. You know, it probably is Waters, or it probably was Waters, but that does sound dumb. So that's
I like that. Names are what we make them.
Well,
you know?
The Waters is kind of like a. I feel like that could be an accent thing.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah.
I do Waters. Wonder sometimes how much of a pronunciation is down to accent.
Gotta be.
Yeah, definitely.
So this last Wednesday, you had a new book come out, Arkham City, which is reuniting you with Danny and our good friend of the show, Aditya Bidikar, and then also having Dave Stewart be the colorist. So almost the whole team you've had for Coffin Bound, and it really blew me away. We'll get into the book, but for me, I liked how much it seemed to be meditative on the mental health kind of crisis in America, and I've never seen a DC book kind of tackle that like in such a like real world way, because like it's usually just Arkham Asylum, and I kind of enjoy that like Jocasta Joy right in the bat is kind of talking about how weird it is that they still call this an asylum 100 years.
Oh, I loved that.
After
yeah.
Anyone's been calling it an asylum, and
called out.
We did an episode. We're huge fans of Coffin Bound here, so it's always it was one of our first episodes. I think it was like episode 9. We had Brian Wickman on, who came on to kind of talk about his love for those books too, which is some of our. Our favorite books. I love that universe, but it was great to see you and Danny back again together. But what was to get off the bat, kind of go right into what was the genesis of like this story? Was because this is like your first, unless I'm wrong, this is your first major like DC Batman universe story, right?
Yeah, it's my first series, for sure. We're like within the DCU. I've done some shorts. I got to do a Batman story with John Paul Leon. Who recently passed, unfortunately.
Oh.
Which was, that one was a really cool one to get to do. But yeah, this is the first time I sort of dove into this stuff long form.
And you killed Man-Bat. You killed Man-Bat.
Oh, yeah, and I killed Man-Bat. Yeah,
Ooh.
I forgot about it. That was one of my favorite calls with the editorial, because they'd sort of emailed me, and the whole thing was very conspiratorial. It was like, we've got this character and we want you to kill him.
Here's the sword.
And they wouldn't tell me who it was until we got on the phone either. So it was this phone call, which was very
cool. Yeah.
I've never felt more like a hitman in my life.
Yeah. It's good to say, you're like a contract killer.
We've got this problem. Yeah. We've got this problem. Make it go away.
We'll call you. Meet us downtown.
I've got the Azrael story coming out this
Wednesday,
week
yeah.
as well, I believe. Which I'm excited about as well. The genesis for Arkham City was kind of a bit sort of long and nebulous and weird in that there was something else I was talking to. So my editor on that is Amadeo Totoro, and she was the editor for a lot of Lucifer as well.
Nice.
And we sort of really connected on that. Yeah, we sort of shared. I guess the aesthetic, you'd say, like sort of vibing on the kind of things which that book definitely hit a lot of those notes. And we were talking when she moved into the Batman office, we started talking about a different project, and for that project I kept pitching just within the sort of thing, I say like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we like brought back this ancient character that no one's talked about in 50 years, and did them in a different way. And I kept doing this to the point where she was like, you know, we've just had the Joker blow up Arkham Asylum, and we've been wondering what happened to the sort of patients that escaped, and, you know, because not everyone probably died. So those sort of ideas kind of melded, and we ended up with Arkham City.
That's really cool. And that fits in the history of our podcast, because Rom, when he was on, the first thing he was talking about, you and Alex, is how you guys are the experts in every unknown character in DC and Marvel, that he will call you right away. He's like, if I'm thinking of a project and I don't know who to call, I call Dan or Alex and go, who's a good character for this? He was talking about you guys are like his encyclopedia for characters, which is cool.
Oh man, you know what? I think Rom thinks I'm an encyclopedia because it's all relative. Alex really knows his stuff, and like I'm somewhere in between. But yeah,
I'm excited to talk to you at some point about working with Alex a lot, because it seems like you two get along real well and write some great books together.
Yeah, we first got partnered up kind of by accident, and then. And it sort of led to White Noise in a weird sort of way.
That's cool.
I like that. Happy accident.
Yeah. Before we move on to that, since I don't want to shy away from Gotham just yet, it's interesting to see that they're just throwing all the people from the asylum into prison. And I was thinking how interesting it would be to see these people wreaking havoc in the prisons. But I don't know. I don't know if we're going to get that, but... I just like the idea of, oh no, they're throwing like supervillains in prison with regular people. That's crazy. Why are they doing that?
I mean, I presume it would be within some modicum of like isolation.
Yeah, so no, exactly.
It makes sense
that they're doing it without the asylum, but
yeah, you probably don't want Professor Pig.
My demented head took the exact opposite of that. I felt bad for them. I was like, these mental health patients shouldn't be in prison.
Oh, I felt bad for them too. I feel bad for the prisoners and for the people, the mental health patients going to prison. These aren't regular mental health patients.
Yeah, I mean, I think people go sort of can forget that it's the asylum for the criminally insane, right, as well.
Exactly.
It's not like anyone who sort of
mental
has
health issues going
a mental health problem is going to Arkham. But I think even within like the real world, like it does just happen a lot where people who have like serious problems which probably could be dealt with in a different way are just bungled into prison. People who are inconvenient. Just sort of get pushed to the side, which is really like a lot of what I kind of wanted to drill into with the book.
It really came across that way. Like, I have some like mental health problems, and reading it as somebody with mental health problems, I was like, man, this is actually really cool that like he's sticking up for people who have like mental health issues in a weird Batman way. Yeah. I didn't feel like, you know, I feel like it can be, in the way that the book handles it, it feels like it could have been like almost a little touchy, like, but stuff like how she says, no one calls it an asylum anymore. Why do they still call it an asylum? And stuff like that just really
drove home. Yeah, I mean, there's a few things I kind of wanted to... Yeah, like, there's also the thing of like... It's obvious, like, we've sort of nodded towards Arkham Asylum, as in a serious house on serious earth, I think a few times already. Something else I was kind of interested in is that book took this very extremely sort of Oedipal approach, like Freudian approach to Batman's psyche, and did that through the asylum. And but the truth is that, as far as I'm concerned, like psychiatry has like massively moved on from Freud, and like most of his theories are pretty much debunked, and they're very, very good, for storytelling like devices, because it's like, you know, it maps onto the hero's journey and all of that, you know, blah 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 sort of technical story stuff, which is very boring. Like it's very good for all of that, but as an actual way of mapping the psyche, it's not particularly good.
You called that out too in the book.
I guess I just wanted to like throw up more questions than trying to throw up answers, because I think that's kind of what mental health tends to be a lot more about. And reading books by psychiatrists before we started this project, for the sake of this project, that also seemed to be like the overwhelming consensus is like, we're doing our best, but we don't know how the brain works is the bottom line.
Well, yeah, the brought up a good point when they were in the office and she had like the archaic device that they put on mental health patients. I don't know what that thing was, but
that was
terrifying.
Vulture's costume from Coffin Bound.
Was it? Yeah. Oh, it was, huh?
It wasn't quite. It wasn't quite, but it was the same thing that we drew before that.
Yeah, it was a little different. The head wasn't quite as cagey, but yeah, so anyway, that thing was terrifying.
That is a real device. It was a straitjacket with a brand.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stop people biting.
But like, you know, 100 years ago, they'd like lobotomize bipolar people, and like,
yeah,
that's how bad the mental health treatment was, and it's still, you know, not great. Like, yeah, I mean, there's so much to explore.
I lived not that far from Bedlam, or what was Bedlam, you know, hospital, Bethlehem Hospital, which was gave rise to the name word Bedlam, which just means chaos now, right? but like originally that was, you know, that was a mental asylum, and that's where they would chuck people, and then they would also then charge people to come gape at the patients. And if the patients
like
weren't doing anything
zoo.
That was sort of interesting,
that's
exactly
fucked up.
Like a zoo.
That's
and
fucked.
If the patients weren't doing anything interesting enough, they would like rile them up. They'd like bang on the bars and poke them with sticks. And so that's, you know,
wow.
Like, I want to say like it's less than, you know, 200 years ago, probably less than 150 years ago, that stuff was going on. And that's where we're coming from. That's where we're trying to build from as a society, and how we treat people who are maybe like wired a little bit differently.
We're totally haunted.
Well, I think you reflected greatly on all this in the book.
Yeah.
No,
we're totally haunted by that completely now, like even in UK or in, you know, America, every time you see an abandoned old mental health hospital, it's always like Zach Baggins is popping in there being like, this is the most haunted place in the world. And really, it was like just, I mean, I feel like it's really haunted in another way, kind of what you're talking about, that the fact we treated people like this once, but it's crazy how spooky you still see it even today, but it wasn't really the patients as much as the way they were treated. Like, I don't think the patients were...
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what makes us treat them like they are haunted places, right? Is the fact that there is like
atrocities,
pain in these
yeah.
And then Reagan here, I mean, in the 80s when he was president, I mean, I was a wee baby, but I didn't really see it, but I know that he shut down like 80% of our mental health hospitals in America. And like, I used to live in the Bay Area, and like South Bay, like Santa Clara, San Jose area, and the whole homeless population there is all from, like, older homeless people are all from one that happened, just completely, like, you know, taking people into a place and then just releasing them without really help or care or really kind of reintroduction to society.
They also took buses into San Francisco and just, like, released buses full of people from mental hospitals into San Francisco, and so that's, like, there's a huge homeless population of people who, like, really need help there. My brother was living there, and go down there all the time, and it was rough.
Joker plot.
Yep,
yeah,
totally.
Which is delivering.
I like the man with with 10 eyes. He was awesome. I am really interested to see how he got if we do get to see how he got that jawbone out, or like more about that.
I don't know,
like,
that I want to see it.
The jawbone
out.
Just like,
I want to know how, but I don't want to see it.
My little question was,
I don't know if
man.
We ever will, which
Explain.
Might even make it this is good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if we can show and get the jawbone out in it's a PG-13 book, right?
That is true. That was right there on
the
cover.
Well, they said he didn't
when
break the skin.
I was like, oh, I'm about to get into some mature stuff. I really liked a lot of things that were going on in this first issue, Dan. I love the psychologist and cop combo in any storytelling, right? Because you can balance the hope and like the the humanity against sort of that like realism and humanism, right? Like, we're gonna do it. When they're taking Ratcatcher off and she's like, put him in a cell with low lights and like keep him calm, and he's like, well, it's Blackgate, they got cells, we'll try, but like, what do you want to do? We got to save as many people as we can. So like the balance of those two conflicting like really human impulses, I think, right? Like the optimism of they can be reformed with the realism of like they almost ate a kid, so like do I want to lean into that? It's really cool and I think powerful as far as storytelling goes.
Yeah, they have different goals, I think. It's always interesting to have characters who are working together who have very different like end goals.
And almost opposed to each other too, like not giving too much away, but like it feels like for as different as their goals are, they should be aligned. But at a certain point they come almost directly into conflict, and it's really going to be cool to watch her balance that.
Good thing too, because otherwise we wouldn't have much
respect. Right, right.
Yeah.
But that part,
I feel like they kind of yin-yang each other at this point, though. So we'll have to see how things escalate.
And then two other things that I really want to touch on real fast. One, I love when people pull up, I'm going to say D tier, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but when you really take these like, I mean, Hatter is pretty A-list, I would say almost. People know him. So like maybe B or C, but like Ten-Eyed Man, Double X, like Pig has really, I think, really like got a thumbprint on our psyche because he comes up all the time and it's always gross and nasty, but he feels like relatively new. But taking these like 50s and 60s characters and like really reinvigorating them for a new era, I love, because it's like a terrifying remnant of our past that comes rearing back to like show its face. And because we looked away from it for so long and we're like, it's cured, we don't need to examine that idea anymore, here they are, like worse than ever, because we never cured it, we just locked it away and it was forgotten. It was down in a cell four levels deep. Not when Batman walks by and sees Joker and Two-Face and all them cool guys. They're like four down, way, way hidden off to the side. So that idea is really cool. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, without giving too much away, that was very much the thought process behind what we did to the Ten-Eyed Man. Was the idea that this is what just happens if you just jam someone in that corner in somewhere as sort of uncanny as like Arkham Asylum, and just left them there, and no one really bothered with them as far as both within Arkham Asylum and in sort of, you know, on the more meta level, like no one really revisits these characters very much.
Right, but when you do, you have such opportunity. I feel like you can bend them so much more, or even break them without the like diehard, I'm a Ten-Eyed Man fan, and like that is not my Ten-Eyed Man. It's like the more terrifying of like, this is what Ten-Eyed Man should have been all along. Why do we not know that it's so bad this way? So, yeah, that's also pretty radical. And then the last thing, and I don't know, because you spoke a little bit about the genesis of it and really wanting to examine some of these unknown or the unspoken sort of things, right? Like the mental health of these patients and like how it reflects a little bit on our current society and the way that even the treatment of Arkham as a building, where they talk about whether it'll be demolished and rebuilt nicer, cleaner, not an asylum anymore, maybe a mental health hospital this time around for the criminally unbalanced. We won't say insane anymore, something along those lines. But it almost feels like this is the kind of book that for me, I always get really excited about when I start seeing, like, there's Batman everywhere. Like, DC is publishing so much Batman that sometimes I'm like, I don't want another story about a billionaire who just, like, kicks ass and messes up people who need help all the time, right? I do love it when he saves the day from the Joker's big plot or does some crazy, thrilling psychological analysis of somebody. It's cool, but it gets repetitive. And then something like this comes along that is not about Batman, but more about the city and how the city changes so many people that, like, it almost feels as like a response to that. The response to there's so much Batman. Why can't we look a little bit more at the, like, nooks and crannies of Batman? I don't want to see the symbol. I want to see, like, what's in between is, like, almost. Like, I want to see the grime that even Batman doesn't care about. And this book feels like it scratches that itch of, like, Gotham is a bad place, and Batman can't be there for everybody. So there are other people that are trying their best, that are doing their jobs, but are have their own desires and their own impulses. So it's...
And I definitely don't think we're the first people to do that. Like, if you look at something like Gotham Central,
oh, yeah.
You know, did it sort of fantastically. Mm-hmm. But I do think, there is this sort of part of me, like, when, you know, because you know, I'm on Twitter, I see the comments when something like this gets announced, and there's, like, you know, like, most people are excited, but there's always one or two, like, oh, great, another Batman book. And it's, I find it kind of weird, because it's like, he's not in it,
right.
First off. Like, I'm happy to say that, like, out the gate, he's not in this book. He's not... Yeah. He's not going to show up in issue 6 and save the day. He's not here.
So much better for
him. This is not a Batman.
That always undercuts Gotham Central.
They only reference him like once.
Like, there would be...
Yeah, and I think that's the only reference to him in the whole thing. But Batman, I think, is such a powerful figure and such a symbol. But I think part of the longevity is that he just has the best characters around him. He's got this amazing supporting cast. You're seeing both, you know, mm-hmm. the side of things, like you know, there's people who love all the Batman family stuff and that side of it. And he's not around for all of that either. I feel like you've gotten more and more like books which are sort of dealing with where you've got sort of like Robins and ex-Robins like just hanging out, and you've also got books like ours where it's just delving into Gotham City. Basically, what's really been built around Batman is this really, really rich world of its own. And I know there's a lot of Bat content, but to me it's I just sort of look at it and go like, yeah, but Gotham City is this fictional place in which you could just tell millions of stories. It's so malleable. You know, you can do everything from Jimmy Olsen to what we're doing. And all of it fits, all of it makes sense, all of it still feels like Gotham City because these characters and these symbols are so strong and so powerful. Which is part of the real joy of doing something like this with Danny and reinventing some of these characters with Danny, is that the two of us already had this, like, you know, I think a pretty strong sense of what we do and we know how we like to work together and the kind of thing we like to create. And we were able to just kind of bring that to Gotham, and Gotham is robust enough that it just seamlessly kind of slips right in.
It works. Totally. Like, I loved it. Every introduction to the character, I mean, you saw, it's right behind me. It's been on the screen the whole time, but I made that pig scene my background just for this, because, like, I mean, Danny's art is incredible. At times, like, Tim Salish, and then a little bit of, like, Miller, or a little Rizzo, but never in a way that feels like a straight clone. Just, like, so much imparted from it. Yeah, yeah. And then with the Dave Stewart colors, like, the richness of the red against the contrast of, like, the black and even, like, the cream of his suit. But, like, just the little hint of pink in his mask, like, terrifying.
Mm.
Yeah. Just brilliant.
We were talking just about, before we recorded, about how great of a collaboration you and Danny are. Me and Chaz, when we were sitting here, because, I mean, we're big fans of all your guys' work together. And I was going to ask, let me see if I'm wrong. How did you guys collaboration begin? The first, I think I might be right, but was the first time you guys did stuff together, she did the variant covers for Deep Roots, right? Am I wrong?
Yeah. We were already doing Coffin Battle at that point. We started, it was quite a long incubation process on that one. So Volt were doing a sort of, that year they did a sort of thing where every book had variant covers by a female artist. And when they sort of, like, said this to me, I was very quickly like, hey, well, I know this amazing artist who's about to be, you know, a real big thing. So I showed them Danny's work and they jumped straight on it because she is fantastic.
Yeah, every time she illustrates a book, I'm like in 110% more. I got the Miracle Molly a few weeks ago and had no idea she was drawing it. So it was like that perfect surprise and opening, being like, oh, Danny's drawing it. And it's tiny. And like, I had such a great time with that issue. And it's just, you know, I'm always completely just like, I sometimes, like Chaz, feel like Tim Salis, but just completely her own. Like, every, the way she, like, interprets action, especially like ethereal worlds. Like for me, like I grew up on like old school Vertigo, and from like that's just my like warm feeling, fuzzy feeling, and like Warren Ellis, sort of like the things I grew up on. So like that's my like nostalgia kick, where my brain starts being like, this is what I want to read. And I feel like your guys' collaboration on Coffinbound and just kind of the way you write in Lucifer is the first time like I feel like that kind of feeling, but not like you're imitating it. Like you're just writing your own stuff, but it gives me that same kind of vibe that like old school Vertigo does, which I mean, I hope this is a compliment, but I really, that's why I fell in love with your work. Like I didn't.
Totally. Like that's, yeah, I mean, that's the stuff which made me want to do this for a living. Particularly stuff like Doom Patrol, yeah. Stuff that you can encounter when you're quite young. And then it brings you to these ideas. Like, you know, I'd never heard of Dada before I read Doom Patrol. I'd probably never heard of like Alistair Crowley before I read Serious House and Serious Earth. And all this stuff when you're encountering, when you're like 14, you're like 15, and you just go, all right, this is all of the stuff you need to know, like to write comics. this is the norm.
Like my experience reading your Lucifer run, like I was a big fan of Mike's run, like growing up. And like, I was like, oh, they're relaunching Sandman. And all the books were good, but like your Lucifer run knocked it out of the park for me. Like I was just like, who is this writer? This is such an like interesting way to tackle Lucifer, because it's such like a complete story too. Like I was one of the people gripped to waiting when it was like that year wait between the one issue and then the trade. Like, and then I ended up buying all of them in trade so I could read all as one. And I'm gonna be probably just because I'm a crazy fan of yours say that. I mean, my personal preference, I have like the hardcovers of Mike Carey's run. Like I have that collected. I have all your trades. I've read them both in the last year, both incredible runs. My personal preference, which you're going to probably say I'm crazy, is I kind of enjoy your run a little more, only because it's shorter. Like, I know, Carey's run is classic, but, like, for me, it's just, you're such a complete run. Like, the ending of yours, the last page especially, like, with the girl that, you know, had, without spoiling too much, had done something awful, and the fact that Lucifer is gone, and like knowing the true core of human nature and why we do things and how we use the devil as a scapegoat. I mean, just the way the series ends to me was like such a perfect kind of statement on how we've used Lucifer and Satan and the devil to kind of scapegoat terrible human actions. I'm pretty sure that's what your intention was, but yeah. It was perfect for me because so many times, like even throughout history, people will do some, you know, horrific act and it's always like, I was possessed. And it's just seeing that kind of accentuated well, and
yeah, I mean they probably use God even
more. Even God even more, yeah. But that's even crazier for me.
I guess like the thing I would say about the difference between mine and Mike's runs is that I like that was one of the first Vertigo books I read.
Me too, yeah.
They had it at the local library, and sort of like just reading random volumes out of order, but like in particular like reading that early sort of like Berlin arc, which is just perfection.
Yeah. It's Western art?
But he enjoys the beginning of that, I think. But like that whole... that I love that run so much. I love Sandman so much. And then I think this is quite a British, like, snark thing, is that my then... therefore, my impulse is to go like, all right, well, I'm doing the opposite of that. so this is brilliant. This is perfect. I'm not...
Well, that's why I enjoyed it so much. It's so different. It's not like just, it's not at all trying to be anything like the run and just taking a completely different look at it.
Yeah, I think that would have been redundant, yeah, because it already exists. It's already exceptionally good. I'm already going to get compared to it. So I might as well just do something totally, totally other.
That's a problem we see so much in pop culture, is like some, especially with movies, like you'll see some movie redone, you know, 20 years later. I mean, we have countless examples, and it's just literally the same story beat for beat with new characters. Like, you see that continually done right now with films, where it's like, this is the sequel of a movie 20 years ago, and like all these movies I'd seen when I was like young and it's not even able to form memories, and I'll be like, wait a second, this is the same exact beats of that story. And just, it's, I mean, I feel like that's studio probably more than creators, so I don't want to make it feel like it's the creator's fault on that. But you see that a lot, so it's always great on an interesting new spin. And then, of course, Coffinbound came out, and that was like, I mean, that was been my favorite book 2 years ago, and was on my top, like, I think it was my second favorite book last year when I was doing my count off. But those those books just completely were, for me, like the return to like Vertigo writing. My friend Johnny, who he has another podcast, we were just, you probably saw our tweets, we raved about that book for so long because something like that's so original and kind of capturing that spirit of books I grew up with without, you know, imitating it. And just the, like, to me, it's almost like a punk rock Dark Night of the Soul and a detachment from life in oneself, from reality, and kind of that whole first series. I love, like, why can't even, is it, what's the agent's name? Like, how, there's so much connection of, like, people, like, you know, detaching themselves, and literally the one guy becomes nothing but a brain and floating liquid at the end of the first arc.
We've all been there. I know I've wanted to be just a brain.
Yeah.
Probably all of 2020.
Yeah.
Most of 2021.
Most of 2021.
Like 60-40.
I loved all the visual storytelling in Coffinbound, and we were remarking on our episode about Coffinbound that the it feels like you two would have had to work together a lot on how the storytelling happens visually. Was that the case? Like the spy versus spy kind of guys, you know, I was like, how the hell did they pull this off? Like,
oh yeah, yeah. This issue 7.
Yeah.
I mean, we really did. It definitely wasn't a case of just, I send Danny a script and then that's it. And I see the finished art. We'd, talk on the phone a lot and on Skype a lot, and she'd send a lot of like layouts and stuff, go like, oh, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? And that's the sort of joy of doing
that's great
a book like that is it's you're trying to get as close as possible to what you both kind of want to put on the page.
Yeah, it really shows in Coffinbound. It's an amazing series, man. Props.
Oh, thanks very much. It's definitely the most what's the word for it? Uncompromised.
Ambitious?
Okay. That's nice. Oh, no, uncompromised. I think nailed it pretty well.
Getting the pure vision out there.
Yeah, I think so, too. Straight out of the brain.
Another great book that's out right now is Homesick Pilots. You're nearing your 10th issue. First question, I'm going to get it out of the pot. Is the 10th issue it, or are we going to get more?
No, we've Casper's drawing issue 11 at the moment. We're going to take just a couple of months just to let him catch up. I think January we'll be back. So it's only trade out volume 2 is out next month, and then 2 months before issue.
I'm excited. I thought it was a 6-issue miniseries originally. So every time like more issues got announced, I was like, yes, more time in this world. Like, bonus. Yeah, bonus issues. Jack, what's funny is Jack was catching up. Me and Chaz have been reading with the releases, but he's busy with like the stuff he does as a musician. I think he read like all of Homesick Pilots in what, the last 2 days, and he's just been like sending me text messages, more and more excited about
how, they're awesome. I wanted to ask you some questions. Like, it seems like you're pretty well versed in like counterculture and punk rock. How did that come to be? Is that something that reflects your inner self at all?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of, you know, I had such a misspent youth. I was like, I might as well utilize this for something.
Well spent. It hit home for me. If you're utilizing it for something, I wouldn't say misspent. Provided you a wealth of materials for now.
You weren't there.
You weren't there.
It was definitely.
Love it.
Definitely misspent if you ask my mom.
Well, that's fair. Probably two different views of that.
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, that was, you know, that wasn't, frankly, still is a big part of my life.
It felt really personal.
Thank you. I'm glad that comes across. Because, like, it's definitely stuff. There's more sort of anecdotes from real life in that book than I think anything else I've put out. It obviously sort of like, you know, warped and changed a little bit to fit the narrative, but there's a lot of stuff which is definitely like directly from my life. And, you know, that's in a book about a haunted house that walks across California,
which is a pretty radical
totally
like blend of ideas. Because I think when I first read the solicit for it, somebody had pitched it to me essentially as like The Overlook from The Shining, but it's like a Voltron Power Rangers robot. And in my mind, I was like,
yeah, pretty much.
I don't know that I can conceptualize that, but I also don't know how I've lived my whole life not knowing I needed this so bad. Like, you know, when something just clicks and you're just like, oh, man, how have I never, ever seen these two things together? Yeah, it's so sick. Just seeing a haunted house walk. Yeah, that, fucking groovy.
Yeah, that came out of me and Casper talking about, because originally we thought we were going to do a second Limbo, or like a sequel, like another book in that.
We talked about that in our episode. We were like, we really wanted more because it ends on such like a pickup.
Yeah, we were pretty naive when we made Limbo about how long these things like generally run, and especially when you're brand new creators and you don't know anyone and you don't know how to promote your book and all of this kind of stuff. We were really winging it on that one, but we sort of had come to this point where like Casper had spent a few years doing stuff on Marvel. I'd spent a few years on Lucifer and Coffin Bound to come out, and we were like, okay, well, maybe let's try and revisit that world. Like maybe, you know, maybe the time's right to sort of do this. And once we started talking about it and what we wanted to do, we came up with these punk kids who were going to be part of the case, and then we ended up liking them more than we liked the story that was around them. So we sort of followed them where they wanted to go, and that's what led to Homesick Pilots.
That seems like a pretty nice journey. Like finding that you like characters more than the situation you would put them in, kind of, I think is a nice twist. Because I think there's probably a lot of people that approach a story as like, this is, I'm going to write characters to serve this story instead of letting the characters become something that can serve a better story.
Yeah, I mean, without getting too into the weeds of craft, I think to approach it sort of story first and then try and slot characters in is generally how you get like relatively flat characters, because if they're there to pin the plot to, that's plot is essentially just characters doing things, right? So if it's moving around them rather than them moving it, then that tends to be a bit of a problem. But yeah, I mean, that still doesn't explain how we got to, you know, a haunted house that walked.
I don't know that anything, Mike, but...
It was great.
Well, I mean, it was definitely like a bit of a thing of looking at ghosts as like trauma.
I think Limbo kind of examined too.
That was a big one, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a really big fan of ghost stories, and I sort of read tons of sort of like M.R. James and all that kind of stuff, and really sort of reading all these sort of Victorian and post-Victorian ghost stories, and then seeing that being visited quite a bit on TV at the moment, on TV and on film, like all the sort of big like blockbuster horror films that are coming out at the moment seem to be all sort of haunted house-esque, you know, the sort of how massive the Conjuring series is, and even Paranormal Activity before that, and all of these things are sort of haunted house things. And I think just for the sake of narrative structure, a lot of them go with this. They go with the sort of trauma metaphor, you know, ghosts as trauma. But then, in order to sort of resolve a plot and get an ending which people are happy with, they resolve the trauma, which isn't how life really works.
Yeah.
You know, all those traumas that people just get over and never think about again for the rest of their
life. They leave the house. Changed forever.
Exactly. So the House That Walks was definitely an attempt to sort of do our version of that, which is that you are never going to leave this haunted house. It's going to, if you try and leave, it's going to walk with you.
Yeah, that's great. I love how the house itself is like scared to come out of the water too. Like, you can really see the house as like having its own sentient being at that point, where earlier it feels like it's the ghosts inside, and like it kind of is, I guess. I don't know. It's really cool.
Yeah, the idea is that the house. So the ghosts are their own people, but they are also like traumas. They are memories of traumas. which, you know, I think is a pretty common take as to what yeah. ghosts are. So the idea of the haunted house is essentially a head full of ghosts. That's, you know, a head full of traumas. That's definitely something that sort of harks back to the Overlook Hotel.
Yeah, I think the explaining them as traumas and seeing them as, like, all the ghosts are angry, and you can see that they're, like, angry about their traumas and almost, like, lose the human part of themselves while they're ghosts is pretty cool. At least that's kind of how I was seeing it.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I love the transformations in this book. Like, when the ghosts become... Like, the looks everybody gets when they're souped up by these ghosts. Or, like, just the design of the ghosts themselves, like the horseshoe ghost. Like, just that, the image of, like, where the head should be, but it's the horn of the horseshoe. Is like, just such a gnarly, cool design.
Yeah, that's real Casper. I think he's genuinely one of the best character designers, like, working at the moment.
Totally agree. This gave me that, like, I don't... particularly care for, like, the new 13 Ghosts, like the 13 Ghosts remake that they did with Tony Shalhoub and all the Matthew Lillard. And
how
all
dare you, Chaz?
But the look of all those ghosts are, like, gnarly as hell. Like, the idea, like, the lore of that movie, I love more than I think I like the movie. Like, like the Black 13, but they're all made up of these gnarly ghosts. Like,
I was watching this thing about it recently, and apparently there's, like, all of this behind-the-scenes stuff which really goes into the...
like, the history of, like, what each ghost was or whatever. And some of them are gross. Like, I spent...
Yeah, they just didn't put it in the movie.
I remember that.
I don't know what they put in.
I remember that when I was, like, 13, when that came out around that age. Because one of the ghosts is straight up, like, the torso killer from, like, Brian Michael Bendis' run Torso. Like, the actual killer that was in Chicago. I remember that one was actually, like, a torso killer that you had to go online, like, through the... old school viral marketing and, like, yeah, research each different ghost, which would have been great, as you said, in the actual movie. I will say it's better than House on Haunted Hill. Like, my wife is a big horror fan. We're horror nuts, so we watch, you know, rewatch horror movies. And we were just recently, like a month ago, we watched 13 Ghosts. And I gotta say, like, I remember it got, like, terrible reviews when it first came out, but compared to, like, there's a great indie horror movies coming out right now, like, a lot of stuff I love, but there's so much horror coming out, and I feel compared to, like, a lot of the horror coming out today, because there's just, you know, a mass unloading of horror films at, like, this time, some high budget, some, you know, low budget, that are, it's not that bad. Like, I remember everyone saying it was, like, a terrible movie, and I mean, it's not great. It would have been really done if they had, it would have been a lot better if they did have those backstories of the ghosts, but I mean, I also don't think it's, like, one of the worst ghost movies I've ever seen. It's got some weird inventive choices, like glasses that you can see ghosts, and Matthew Lillard.
That was a cool thing back in the day in the original. The 3D glasses, like, I remember getting the, like, DVD of it, and it came with the glasses, so you could, like, oh, too scary, I'm gonna take these off. I don't want to see the ghost.
But I think that's something they took from the original 13 Ghosts as well.
That,
right?
Cool, like, the Castle promo, because he was always trying to, like, get butts in seats by, like, oh, you can see the ghost. Put on special glasses. Like, if a horror movie did that today, I'd be like, I don't want to get scared in the theater, but I'll go put on some cool glasses and see a ghost and take them off. I don't see him. Like,
or a flying skeleton in House of Haunted Hill, right?
Like, dropped down from the ceiling. Like,
was it House on Hill where he did that in the theater? Like, dropped the skeletons down?
Because the end is the skeleton coming out of the house. Sorry, spoilers for a 60-year-old movie.
Somebody out there is like, I'm looking this up, and then just heard that, and it's like, oh.
I don't know if it mentioned it when it...
I mean, it's still worth watching for me.
I love to know. It's like, I mean, I'm not even a Power Rangers fan, but I know that's what Chaz got so excited for with Homesick Pilots. Like, I was excited to read it, and he was so enthusiastic. He used to be a manager at my local comic book shop. That's how we became friends. And he was so enthusiastic about Homesick Pilots. Like, when he got this preview copy before I'd read it, he was just like, oh, man. And I think you got, like, 3 issues at first. Did you get 3 at first?
Yeah. It was 3, and I was so excited the next month when 2 came out. And then I opened it and realized, like, damn it. It's going to be, like, 3 more months before I read a new one. But it was worth it. It was reread them as they
came out. I know that feeling. I get some promos enough.
Yep. We open it up thinking like, oh yes, this book finally. Wait, is this flashback? Oh no, I read this already. Damn it.
Yeah.
I do reviews for Vault, and that and another book you have out right now. I think you might know, because you'll probably know way better than me. Is the fourth issue might be coming out soon, but I absolutely love The Picture of Everything Else. Last year, December, that was like my favorite book of December. I know it's like very much, you know, a take on the picture of Dorian Gray and all Oscar Wilde. But for me, which everyone kept on being like, you're wrong, it's Oscar Wilde. It gave me actually a very, like, I love Charles Dickens as a kid. Like, same time I got into comics, I read a lot of Dickens, even stuff I shouldn't have read when I was like eight. But I read like Tale of Two Cities at 8 years old, read Great Expectations, like all of his books. And like, for some reason, even though I know it's obviously based on Oscar Wilde's work and a character he created, it really gave me a Charles Dickens vibe. Like, it's this like vibe I only get sometimes when I'm reading Charles Dickens, but it's probably just the setting of the book. But I was just absolutely enamored with that first issue and kind of how we're introduced to the two main characters. And then who's not, I mean, I wouldn't even call him a villain, but you know, the portrait painter of Dorian Gray and kind of the turmoil he creates in the beginning. I mean, yeah, he's obviously like the main villain, but you definitely do a good way of painting him as a character kind of damaged by what Dorian Gray did to him. And I mean, yeah, he's definitely, I mean, he.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, that was definitely the impetus for the book, was, you know, sort of the spark for the book was going back through Dorian Gray, which is one of those books I feel you can revisit at different stages of your life, and it just hits totally differently. I remember reading it when I was sort of younger and finding it just this cool sort of gothic story, and then you start getting a little bit older and you start understanding different things about it. And then the more I sort of dug into Wilde and his life and learned more about him, the sort of metaphor of the whole thing became a lot clearer and a lot sadder in a lot of ways, particularly when you know what happened to him after the release of that book. But just revisiting it and sort of seeing a few versions of it brought onto like TV and film, like he was like Dorian Gray shows up in like Penny Dreadful and the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen film, which we will say no more about.
It is a movie.
It definitely exists.
I was the worst person in high school. I talked a bunch of my friends to go see that movie.
But like,
I was excited about it because the comic book. So it was like me and 10 other people who had never read a comic book in their life. And then like the food we got afterwards, it was like 10 people staring at me like, what did you do? And me just being like, the comic's much different.
That was 10 people
who
still never read a comic.
Yeah, didn't win hearts and minds, that one.
But Dorian Gray kept popping up in these things and just being a sort of sexy evil guy with an immortal painting. And I just kept sort of looking at the book and going, like, what about the guy? I mean, the book doesn't address it, but that's fine. The book's like 150 pages. It can't address much. What about the guy who painted an immortal picture? The book never goes into how he did it or, you know, why it happened. Because that's not the point of the book. But I thought there was a lot of interesting story to
find. I'm the dummy that it took the third issue, kind of the events that happen, and you know, the kind of miraculous thing that happens with the painting of the city, to me go, oh, that's what the title means. Because the whole time I was like, what does that mean? And then I was like, ah, I get it now. Everything else besides Dorian Gray. I'm really excited for that to continue.
So I do want to ask, like, more about how you and Pac Nadel and the rest of the White Noise crew all came together.
So I've known Ryan forever, roughly.
Okay.
No, we worked together years ago. And you know, we've been and so did Casper, funny enough. We all met together working at this sort of micro publisher. In London, and then we met Ram at Thought Bubble, and sort of around the same time, I was asked if I wanted to write an Assassin's Creed comic, and if I wanted to do that was with this other bloke, with Alex Patton, though, who I think I'd met like once, or like maybe twice at that point. But as we were sort of hanging out in London, Ryan and Ram and I were hanging out in London, and I was working with Alex, and then Ram floated this idea of putting together a studio because we were all people who had pretty similar thoughts on comics, and we were trying to do similar things. And I say similar, I just mean, you know, within the similar sort of mindset.
Totally.
And then I was like, well, I'm, you know, writing with this guy, and he's really great, and I think he's totally on the same wavelength as well. So we brought Alex in, and the rest was,
you guys were together in the book White Noises on a Table, right? We were first all meeting.
Yeah, I borrowed it off Rom, and I brought it back. We Ryan and Rom and I met in a pub, and I brought Rom's copy of White Noise to give back to him. So when we talked about, like, oh, like, maybe we should name this thing, it was right there on the table. Which sounds, and that sounds made up, but it's not.
That's kind of story.
There was also people who tried to talk us out of calling ourselves White Noise, because they were like, isn't White Noise the thing which, like, just happens in the background while no one's paying any attention?
Static.
We were like, yeah, but
it's also cool and soothing.
I was going to say, it works. Even if you don't hear it, your mind hears it. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I put you to sleep. I don't know.
Well, with their books.
Right. No, yeah, not this part. These are a lot more engaging. The fact that I got to use my eyes and my brain at the same time and my hands. So, yeah, you're getting lots of senses in the mix.
It was just a name that seemed to work, and we got to feel sort of snooty about it.
I always feel like a crazy conspiracy person with it, because I always then see it in a lot of your works, like in Limbo, when the white noise of the TV kind of kicks off the first issue when he's paying attention to it, and then one of Rom's first books, Black Mamba, is like, the rain, it's all made of white noise, so I keep on being like a conspiracy nut, being like, look at all these connections, they're calling white noise everywhere, which is, I feel like some of those, I mean, Black Mamba had, I think maybe it was before you guys even formed, right, so that's just... Yeah, that's just Limbo. So that's just
I think both those books. I think both those books are actually. But maybe that also just shows that it was something that we liked the idea of.
Definitely.
And the sound of.
Made sense. So Arkham City. The one thing I want to ask, you know, before we take off or we end the meeting, is that I'm excited to read your Azrael take in Urban Legends when it comes out, because he's a character I definitely think could use a reinvention, so I'm excited to see your take on him. And I like, so far we've only seen him as like almost like a hulking monster kind of chasing Mad Hatter in the book. Is he gonna have like a more central role in the story? Is Urban Legends kind of good to read with it to kind of take part? Is he
I mean they're definitely different. I read Urban Legends a little while before, and then they said, you know, like, we want to revisit Azrael, and we thought you might be the right guy to do that. I don't know. They were like, and they were kind of like, we don't know if you've ever heard of this guy or whatnot. And I was like, well, they didn't say whatnot because they're not from London.
They know how cool Azrael is.
Hey, I say whatnot all the time.
they sort of said, oh, we don't know if you've heard of this guy. I was like, well, I had Nightfall on. Audio CD as a kid somehow. Dirk Maggs made an audio version for the BBC. Dirk Maggs, who's just made the Sandman, right? He's doing the Sandman audible version. So I had that as a kid. So I was like super aware of Azrael as a child. And then I was kind of like, all right, so you've got this, you know, coming off the back of Lucifer, I was like, you've got this Catholic, brainwashed sort of Moon Knight character. Like, yeah, I'm all over that. And he's just a really, really interesting character on that side as well, like trying to dig into the religion and the faith a little bit, which we've seen in other takes of Azrael. Like, okay, like, yeah, he's Azrael, he's brainwashed as this sort of, you know, to believe that he's an angel of vengeance, and that everything he's doing is righteous and for God, even though it's for this offshoot of the Knights Templar who've made themselves very, very rich. But there hasn't been much grappling with John Paul's own religious beliefs. Like, we don't really know if he even sort of has any. So that was something that I really wanted to get into with Urban Legends. Then when we came to do Arkham City, we had a bit of discussion about who would be sort of after these guys. And Azure just seemed to like fit right in there as well, in that he was someone that we'd just been working with, and he has this sort of edge to him which makes him, he's somewhere on that line as well, right? He's someone whose brain has literally been tampered with. So it's sort of interesting to see him in that way. So Urban Legends happens before Arkham City, but the take you'll see from him is quite different, because you're only in Arkham City again. Like, it's not a bad family book. It's not about superheroes. So he is a presence there more than he's a POV character. Whereas Urban Legends is his story.
Yeah, I'm excited. Like, yeah, I like that too. His presence was definitely felt in the first issue. And speaking of dream books, even though, you know, you work for DC, I can only imagine how crazy your take on Moon Knight would be. That'd be definitely something. Danny and you, Moon Knight, I mean, that would get my money right away. That'd be one of the most excited books.
The current Moon Knight run
is really cool. Yeah, I've been loving it. The first issue with the Hunter's Moon and the baseball bat just got me that real good energy of of just like old school. I'm a huge Moon Knight fan and a big fan of her. That's one of the few characters of Marvel I collect, like, everything. I love, you know, the Ellis run, the Lemire run, the old school run, and definitely this run's great too. I kind of like that we get a kind of different take on Moon Knight every few years, and then he goes away and comes back, and so it's kind of cool to get excited by him. I mean, now that he has a Marvel series coming out, maybe we'll be able to get some longevity with the Moon Knight book, which we've always wanted as well. So I've been really enjoying the McKay run.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've definitely hit a point where people have realized the sort of potential of that character, which is really cool.
I always think Moon Knight, She-Hulk, and Ghost Rider are like cursed titles. No matter how good they are, they're always good. They always launch with like a real good team. And then right around like 10 or so issues, sales will trail a little bit, and they'll say, final issue coming up. And then sales will pick back up because everyone who was on the fence is now like telling all their, you got to grab Moon Knight. You got to grab this book. You got to grab, it's so badass right now. And then they say, oh, never mind. Like, we reversed. We're going longer. And then everybody gets complacent again, and they're like, all right, cool. It's going to be around forever. I could drop it for now and pick it up later. And then it ends up canceled. And then they have a new 6-issue miniseries because everybody who was a core reader is, like, clamoring for it. So they're like, here's 6 more from a new creative team. And then that 6 gets turned into 12, and then that 12 cancels. It's just a relentless cycle.
Yeah, I mean, them's comics.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very true.
Very,
very true.
Yeah. Once again, I do want to thank you so much for coming on. Like, really, I've been kind of nervous of your work. I appreciate you being on here. We seem nervous, or I seem nervous. I apologize. I just really love your work, and it's great to have you on here.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot.
Yeah, I really would hopefully like to get all you guys one day, maybe Ryan. I mean, probably more tangential, but just to have like for a real, Christmas man. Fun party. Our dream is the Very White Noise Christmas. If we can get all you on, Christmas. I mean, it would be hard because it'll be so many people on, but I mean, at that point, I think we would just have fun. I mean, Alex is very good at just running the conversation. When we had our episode with him, we had all these questions. We only got like 2 out because Alex just took over the whole show, which is great. Like, he came in, he came in immediately. Was like, you guys want to talk about the London Underground? And then he went into like a good analysis of the London Underground, and it was great. He's I feel like we did that, he'd be probably running the whole show too on that.
Alex has a PhD and it shows.
Yeah. All you guys have been it's so great to have on. Aditya is also, he's like almost like one of the unspoken members of, he's great, and he's been so supportive of us, which we've always appreciated, and he's a blast to have on every time, and all you guys have been so fun to bring on. I wanted to bring up real quick, because Halloween, not comic related, everyone seems to be talking about John Carpenter right now. There's like, I don't know, 3 podcasts I listen to and a YouTube channel on John Carpenter. You're a John Carpenter fan, right?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say your favorite John Carpenter movie is? I say The Thing. I love The Thing, but I also love Prince of Darkness. But if I had to pick two, those are the two ones I like the most. They're all good, though. Not trying to discredit any other work.
Yeah, I might just be really boring and I'd be honest, and it's Halloween. The Thing is also very, very special. Prince of Darkness, I feel like
that's good.
That's another one like 13 Ghosts, a little bit to me, where it's like it's so cool at its heart, and it just kind of meanders off in all these directions.
Drops.
I'm not quite sure why.
Yeah.
Like
watching somebody walk to your table with a big full bowl and it's like spilling out as it's getting closer to you, and you're like, no, 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 no. And by the time it's to you, it's empty, and you're just like, oh, I really wanted what was in there.
I don't know. I think my favorite Carmen film probably changes day by day, if I'm honest. but Halloween's just such a... there's so much that wouldn't exist without it. And it does what it does so perfectly, and there's not been...
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very rarely been matched by countless imitators.
Yeah, I mean, launch the slasher, pretty much slasher genre in every film afterwards. I mean, that and Texas Chainsaw, but really, Halloween is really the one everyone tries to imitate. Pretty much every horror movie involves, like...
And it's there's a minimalism to it as well, where it's like, it's just good storytelling. There's nothing else really going on. Like, it's the most basic mask, the most basic killer. He uses a basic kitchen knife, and everything is just this. It's like pared right down. So there's nothing in that film that doesn't need to be there. Even the music being just like one synth.
Yeah.
Yeah. The music in that
makes a scene in a closet so terrifying. Just a simple scene of someone in a closet trying to hide from a killer. Yeah, absolutely gripping. Well,
man, I forgot. John Carpenter did Ghosts of Mars. Is that going to be my favorite? No, I'm just kidding. It's probably That's Big Trouble in Little
too.
China.
They Live's great, too. So many are great.
Man, I forgot he did that one, too. Memoirs of an Invisible Man. I'm going to do a John Carpenter other movie.
It's great to watch.
Marathon later.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate you. And everyone listening, make sure to get Arkham City. And also the second volume of Homesick Pilots comes out next month. And... anything else you wanted to pitch coming out soon?
Urban Legends. Urban Legends. Week, I believe. So, yeah.
Definitely get Urban Legends. Federici.
Excited about that one.
I'm super excited for a C cover.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Ricardo's amazing. But thank you so much for having me on. It's been a blast. And anytime you guys want, I'm happy to come back.
We appreciate you, Dan. Yeah, I'm excited for anything else.
Right on. Yeah, we appreciate
coming
that.
Out. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
We'll have to bring you on later in the Arkham series, and after Homesick Pilots is finished, and then we can reassess all this. Yeah.
I'll read the lore of 13 Ghosts, the remake, and then just talk about this.
Yeah. We'll binge watch all the
there's a lot of them
movies and
all of them except for Ghosts of Mars.
Yeah, all of them.
Have a great day. Cheers, Sam.
Been great. Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah, it's been great to meet you, man.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for listening to our 50th episode, and thank you so much to Dan Waters for coming on. You can follow Dan on Twitter at DanPGWaters, and I, of course. And Poet Air, you can follow me on Twitter at PoetAir33. Thank you all for listening for the last 50 episodes. We appreciate all your support. And you can find the show at Outside The with a 0 instead of an O. You can find Chaz on Twitter at Chaz Simons, all lowercase, at twitter.com. And Jack, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram or Twitter at sin_aesthetics with an X.
And make sure to check out Urban Legends this Wednesday, and definitely get Arkham City on your pull as well, and of course, Homesick Pilots. And if you have to catch up, Volume 2 comes out next month, and the first trade is available now to order from your LCS, or if you have to, order it from Amazon if you're not near a comic book shop or on Comixology. And in the spirit of our amazing co-host, I would like to say, turn the page, wash your hands. We'll be right back.
pages.